Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
Hello, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and I have on the line my intrepid co-host, Mr. Chris Sheridan. How you doing, Chris?
Doing great, Jason. Looking forward to this
one. Yeah. Exactly. This is going to be a fun one. We're talking about Isis, Virgin of the World. It is chapter eight, Roman numeral eight in the Big Book of Secret Teachings, Manly P. Hall's classic work. And we're going to get into the symbolism of Isis, alchemical and hermetic symbolism of Isis, a little bit about her story and more fun stuff. We, of course, are here each Sunday talking about the ancient wisdom, psychology, occult subject matter, ancient mysteries and technologies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We encourage you to send your questions or your comments in. You can reach us at info@cosmiceye.org. Check us out at cosmiceye.org or at Chris's website, chrissheridan.com. I'm the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky. And like I said, we're here each week. We appreciate your support. Also on Anchor FM, you can go to anchor.fm/cosmiceye, and you can support the podcast and the new video cast of this that we're doing. I don't know, what do you call that, a vlog? What are the kids calling it these days?
Video podcast. Yeah, I don't know.
Video podcast, what have you. That it is actually nice to do this one with the video, because much of this chapter is dedicated to an exposition of the Saitic Isis, which is a particular image of Isis, which was found in Sais in Egypt. And there's a beautiful Knapp image. Knapp was the artist who did the all the wonderful illustrations and secret teachings, the color ones. And this is actually from, I'll show that real quick here. Maybe we could pop that up on the screen and some post-production, but I'll also kind of just show it here real quick. It is this beautiful image of Isis. I'm not holding it very well, but we'll pop in something there as well. So that's the image that we're going to be drawing a lot of the hermetic and alchemical symbolism from when we speak in that regard. Okay. So thank you again, supporters, for supporting the show. Please consider supporting us if you are not. And with that, we're going to jump right into Isis, Virgin of the World. All right, so I want to read the quote, the beginning of this chapter, because I think it really sets it up well. So forgive me for looking down, but I can set this up a little bit higher. So it is especially fitting that a study of hermetic symbolism should begin with a discussion of the symbols and attributes of the Saitic Isis. This is the Isis of Sais, famous for the inscription concerning her, which appeared on the front of her temple in that city and reads as follows: I, Isis, am all that has been, that is, or shall, that is or shall be. No mortal man hath ever me unveiled. Hath ever me unveiled. So this is the Virgin Isis, the Isis of the world. Another symbolism of that would be the Great Mother archetype, Mother Nature, the womb of creation, as it were. All right, so when we understand that, we can kind of see where we're headed, speaking a little bit more about Isis, the Virgin of the World. So Sais, as I said, is a city in Egypt where this statue was found. This inscription and the statue were seen and commented on by Plutarch, who was a Greek writer, late 1st century, early 2nd century, Greek writer of importance, biographer and an essayist in ancient Greece. So we know much of this information comes from the Greeks. This, of course, is a time when there's a lot of cultural sort of borrowing and a lot of intermingling, obviously, in Egypt and Greece, the time of Alexandria, and so forth. So Greek culture is infused into Egypt, and Egyptian culture is fused into the Greek culture. All right, so what is this veiled statue of Isis? The veil, as we said, is a symbol of, I didn't say this, but the veil is a symbol of the mysteries. symbol of virginity. That's where they get, where we're getting Manly Hall's title, Virgin of the World. So essentially the symbolism that's at work is very similar to the idea of the Virgin Mary. And they're definitely connected symbolically. All right. So,
and with Hermeticism, I'm going to share that, yep, you know, this Isis is very much linked to the Hermetic tradition and symbolism. It's also that sealed nature of the mysteries, the veil that keeps the profane from the sacred.
That's a great point. And it's that idea too, not so much that it's a secret that's being purposefully kept from anyone, but although that was the case in some cases with the information, but it's a secret that can only be known internally and only through a certain attitude and a certain type of, esoteric work that occurs within one that allows that to unfold. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, the true veil is the one that we have. We have our own blinders. We have our own shield that keeps us from truth. And that's generally our own ignorance or our own stubbornness or our reliance on ego and material matters. That becomes our own barrier. Not that something's being kept from us. We're kind of keeping ourselves from this. Not because we're not prepared. So the removing of the veil is our own ignorance that is keeping us from seeing the truth.
Definitely. And that's, I'm jumping ahead of myself a little bit, but that is one of that ignorance and that sort of egotism and that kind of sort of symbolism goes along with Isis's brother, Seth. And that is one of his sort of attributes. And I think the story that we'll get into, you'll see how that works into it. So let me share another Manly Hall quote. He's speaking on Isis here. And this kind of is a nice summary of this whole symbolic nature of Isis. He says, "This Egyptian deity, under many names, appears as the principle of natural fecundity," fecundity being the generative quality of the earth, "among nearly all the religions of the ancient world. She was known as the goddess with 10,000 appellations," that's names, "and was metamorphosed, am I saying that right?
I think so.
Metamorphosed by Christianity into the Virgin Mary. For Isis, although she gave birth to all living things, chief among them the sun, still remained a virgin according to the legendary accounts." So what you're seeing here is a symbol of really the matrix upon which all life comes from. It's nature. It's more than nature, though. It's the principle of growth. It's the principle of life that's being spoken of here. So in essence, what I think we're looking at here, like I said earlier, is a symbol of the Great Mother, There's no, disconnect between the idea of the Great Mother and the idea of our modern name of Mother Nature, which we call, Earth and nature and this place we inhabit. But it's referring to really the idea that goes beyond that sort of invisible. It does refer to the Earth itself, but it's the sort of invisible energy or the archetypal energy which allows materiality to exist.
Right. It's not just the life. Right? And living things, because she has dominion over minerals as well as plants and animals. It's the process. It's the functioning aspect of life giving, whereas the life object or living creature would be the manifestation of that. But yeah, very good point. It's not just the earthly things. It's that which gives birth to the earthly things. And I think the Matrix is really such a great because it's, mater, material. It comes from the mother etymology as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we as modern people who have watched a lot of films think about the movie The Matrix, and maybe that's the first thing that pops into our mind when we hear the word Matrix. But Matrix really just means a sort of a foundation upon which something comes out of, or upon which something can be built. And essentially, I mean, that's the symbolism of the Matrix itself. Some sort of in the movie, a reality is sort of superimposed on the real reality that existed there. So at any rate, take a look here real quick and see where I wanted to go next with this. The challenge with this particular section is a very short, it's a very short chapter, but it's just packed with explanations of symbolism and alchemy and hermetic symbolism and so forth. So I just wanted to make sure we're on track and getting into all the areas I wanted to cover that we wanted to go over. Okay, so what I will do actually is I'll hand this over to you because I feel like I'm monopolizing this. But on 122, where Apuleius does his description. So Apuleius wrote a book. He was a Roman who wrote a book. Actually was a Roman who was initiated into the mysteries of Isis, and he wrote a mythological tale, which is basically his story, but in a sort of allegorical form of his journey to finding this wisdom in the Temple of Isis, which he eventually found. It's called The Golden Ass. And an excellent commentary analysis of that is Marie-Louise von Franz's analysis. She does a Jungian interpretation of that, and I highly recommend it. The Golden Ass, it's called, by Apuleius, Apuleius. So I'm just going to go through this very, very briefly. This is the story of Isis, where she comes from and where she's going. And just to give it context when we talk about the symbolism. So the story is Isis is the daughter of Geb and Nut. Geb is the earth and the symbol, and Nut is the sky, which is a feminine symbol. And that's very interesting because Egypt is one of the very few cultures that has that. Most cultures have that reverse. The sky god is normally male. The earth is normally female. Why the Egyptians do that, we do not know, but it's very interesting. So she is the daughter of four. There's four children of this union. Isis and Osiris, who is her brother and later becomes her husband, they become the king and queen of Egypt. And Seth and Nephthys are the other siblings, and they're sort of the dark shadow figures in this quaternity or quaternary system. And so basically what happens is Osiris is the king, and he is going around. He's a good king, and he's going around and sharing wisdom and understanding. In addition, Osiris is recognized as the legitimate son of Ra, who is actually the father sun god, Amun-Ra, Ra, one of the old gods. He's considered the sort of legitimate son. In some cases, in later times, he's actually considered the same as or even greater than Ra himself. So it just depends on what period of Egyptian history. Remember, Egyptian history lasts a long time, and these stories morph and change. So we're giving one account of one particular period of time, but this is kind of the one that hermeticists and modern people look back on and use as sort of an exemplary story. So Isis and Osiris are king and queen. When Osiris is away and doing business out in the kingdom and sharing wisdom and solving problems, Isis is guarding the kingdom and making decisions, and she's a just ruler as well. There becomes jealousy between her sister Nephthys and Seth, and of course Osiris and Isis, and Seth ends up wanting to overthrow his brother Osiris. So he devises this means whereby he's going to trap him. He makes this chest or a sepulcher or a coffin that's very beautiful, and then he offers it to anyone who can fit inside of it perfectly, and he's built it exactly to the specifications of Osiris. So he basically tricks Osiris into getting into it. Him and his minions seal it up, cover it with lead, throw it into the Nile, and it floats out into an area called Byblos, which is where the reeds were, and there was a kingdom there. This is actually where papyrus comes from. So Isis goes out, and she's mourning the loss of Osiris. She hears that he has been trapped, and he's gone. She looks around all over for him, finally finds him in Byblos. He has actually, his coffin has, a tree has grown around it, and the king of Byblos has cut it down and used it as a pillar in the palace. Isis gets more or less a job as a nanny with the queen of Byblos and is looking after her child. And she turns into a sparrow and flies around mourning this pillar. At a certain point, she's actually doing, it's interesting. She's taking the son of the queen there and putting him into fire and trying to make him immortal. The queen comes in one day and sees Isis doing this and thinks she's trying to kill her child. So Isis is basically kicked out, but she makes a deal that she can take the pillar, which her husband Osiris is in, and they offer it to her, give it to her. She takes it, cuts it open. Osiris is in there dead. Isis actually has sex with his body and conceives Horus. And then she leaves the body. Seth gets a hold of the body, cuts it into 14 pieces and scatters it all over Egypt at that point. It goes on much longer and it's much more detailed, but that's essentially the gist of the story. There's a great amount of symbolism in all that, both astrological and astrotheological, that has to do with the sun and so on. But we'll not get into that right at the moment, but we'll kind of jump more into some of the symbolism of the actual image of Isis and what that means. I wanted to let you take that. So I just wanted to contextualize that. That's the basic story, and please take over now.
Well, sure. That's a good telling of the Isis-Osiris myth that we're all familiar with in some level, but that kind of gets a little more detailed. And I like this kind of gathering all the pieces together, this kind of reintegration of these broken pieces that are near and dear to our soul. And we've talked about that, about depth psychology and certainly a Jungian standpoint, that these pieces need to be brought back together so we can become whole, because they're all aspects of ourselves. And Osiris is also sometimes depicted as, see, like the lower half of his body is mummified or it's wrapped, that he kind of literally has one foot in the grave, which kind of puts him in the underworld in a lot of ways. So here is this father god who is also distant. So whether it's a sky god or an underworld god, seemingly far away, and it doesn't seem to get past this virgin layer, because with Isis and the Virgin Mary, you know, there's this sense of purity that purification has taken place, and it can't be defiled because it's, as you mentioned earlier, although it may spend time in the material physical world, that Isis and, you know, other deities are not corruptible. They're not going to be taken in or defiled, or however you want to say it, with the mortal things that we can so become so defiled. So there's this purity, and alchemically it's the prima material, this, you know, first substance that really can't be corrupted in any way. But as far as the symbolism goes, now the veil is something that is one of the most common imagery associated with Isis, and that it can't be revealed. But an interesting take on the word to veil or to reveal actually means to reveil. Because we know as we go through life, it's like an onion layer. You peel one layer back and you go, wow, I'm glad I learned this and I've cracked this egg and I've uncovered this mystery. And now I know that, oh, wait, there's something behind it. And it reminds me of a great quote by Richard Feynman, the physicist. Very, very interesting. You should look him up or follow some quotes, because the way he talks about science and learning and wisdom and what can be known and how you can know things and some of the dangers of being, I know this and I'm an authority on that. One of the quotes, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, he says that with every great scientific discovery comes an even deeper mystery. So to reveal almost means to reveil. So you really can't get through it and what's behind it is truth. And maybe we can never get to ultimate truth, the unknowable, all that is. But we can get closer to it. And what we can do is get further away from the untruths that we have that are bombarding us all the time in this material plane. As far as the additional symbolism, she has earrings. One is the earth, one is the moon. And she, you know, sort of the celestial aspect. There's a darkness to her. We're talking about Chem, the darkness of Egypt, when the floodplains are inundated by the Nile. You have this darkness, but that's what where life comes through.
Speaking of that, really, we just interrupt real quick. Chem, they're one of the etymological sort of explanations of the word alchemy is related to that word Chem. That was the ancient word Chema, or Kemet, sometimes it's known as. That's the word for ancient Egypt in the ancient Egyptian language, which does mean black or land of black earth or something along these lines. It's related to that imagery.
Well, yeah, and the blackness is, you know, the shadow. That's what is maybe unknowable or unseen or invisible, is the darkness of the mystery, or even, you know, occult, things that are, you know, it's occluded, it's covered up. And there's sure. this covering, and that's what we get through. I found one of the interesting symbols that she holds in her hand is, it's called a sistrum. It's like a noisemaker, a little more elaborate than a baby rattle, but it has like cymbal or, you know, castanet-sized little chimes. So in the shaking of it, you know, there's a rhythmic, because it bangs against the sides of this like little baby tennis racket. But there's also a tone, more of a kind of like a musical tone. And what's behind that, the meaning of the symbolism, is that the movement of life, the procession of the planets and the equinoxes and everything, is ongoing. Life goes on. And the Earth Mother knows this. You really can't stop. So this constant noise making is to rouse us from, falling asleep in the material world, or becoming, asleep in the sense that you're not aware, you're not present, you're not in tune with what's going on. And we can become set in our ways, or sedentary, even just emotionally or psychologically. So this, and it also reminds me of the drum that Shiva has in one of Shiva's four arms. The name escapes me right now, but the Indian, East Indian drum that has the clackers on both sides. And that's the, like the heartbeat, the pulse of the cosmos, you know, that it is a living, breathing thing. So there's kind of an interesting there. There's a sound element, because Isis, you think, you know, the veiling, and that's certainly part of it. But there's also this sound that keeps us going. In her other hand, she holds essentially a scales. This balance between the moon and the sun, between heaven and earth, the visible and invisible, truth and not truth, weighing that out. So the blind justice figure that the Greeks, later, I guess I probably derived it from this Isis imagery.
Let me jump in real quick. That sistrum, I wanted to go back to that a little bit. I find that really interesting too. As Manly Hall pointed out, that it's in the tone that it made was F. It's Fa. I found that interesting. Like that's the specific note that it played was an F, and that has to do with the harmony of the universe, I guess, or something in terms of the symbolism there. Did you see that, where he pointed that out?
I did, and that's that kind of leads to the next aspect of Isis, because in the musical scale, you know, it's a do, re, mi, fa. It's the fourth tone in the scale, and this number four comes up quite a bit with Isis, because four being the material world, there's even a kind of an empty picture frame that's depicted in one of her hands, that the four elements from which, you know, everything emanates. So this number four comes up a lot. It's really encoded in the ISIS.
Well, and then she's also one of four siblings as well, which is an interesting symbolic touch as in addition.
Okay. Well, there's like, it's really rich in symbolism, and we could dedicate hours to just some of the very encoded symbols. But there are symbols of life, whether it's wheat. There's some snakes. There is the harvest, like some grapes. And since she's the earth goddess, and we're talking about the Nile bringing life to the Giza Plateau and that area. All over Egypt, that this growth comes out, this life, and there's an interesting combination of humidity, because this water element comes again. Water, you can think of the moon, or it's more of a feminine symbolic aspect, but it also needs the fire from the sun to purify it and to channel it into what it needs to be. Otherwise, you just kind of have this dense moisture, but very much a watering aspect to this symbolism.
Yeah, that I found that really interesting. And the next chapter is actually all about the sun. So they definitely work together. The next chapter in Secret Teaching is all about the sun god. Archetype. Getting back to that sort of water symbolism, I wanted to add something to that that I found in here that I found quite interesting. It is this idea that, so you have this idea that Isis is the watery element of life, and then that combined with the sun, or combined with heat, is what materiality sort of comes out of, and that's an alchemical idea. That is actually one of the symbols of that is the Star of David, which is the two triangles, one facing upward, one facing downward, and those two interlocking symbols being fire and water, and then the union of those. The other thing that's interesting about that is how Isis later becomes sort of associated with the Virgin Mary, which I talked about very, very, very early on. Mary, the word Mary is associated with the word Mar, which is the Latin word for sea, another watery symbol. And and that connects, actually, there's a connection in Afro-Caribbean religion between the Virgin Mary and different aspects of her and Yoruba deities, such as Yemaya, who's associated with the Virgin Mary. So there's, many, many cultures have this association with this great mother being associated or symbolizing water. Now, why is that? Water, there's two possibilities for that. One is that water represents the unconscious, and we're talking about consciousness coming up out of this sort of chaos, or undifferentiated sort of, cosmic soup or something. And then the other one is a more sort of biological explanation of, life developing, for example, out of water, or out of the ocean, which is one of the evolutionary theories. So it could refer to one or the other, or it could refer to both of them and even more. And that's the beauty of symbolism. That's, really just to take a quick side note. I talked about this a little bit earlier, not with you, but I was thinking about this. The difference between a sign and a symbol, and Manly Hall's talked about that before. A sign is something that refers to something specific. It's a symbol, like a stop sign. It means stop in your car. You know that. It's not a symbol. A symbol is something that is open. It has open interpretation. It may have, one or five or 10 different sort of accepted meanings, but it can't be pinned down. It's bigger than a sign, and it's open to interpretation, and it refers to something that's mysterious. That's the thing we have to remember about the difference between a sign and a symbol. And this is where people get caught up in thinking, I'm going to crack the code like the Da Vinci Code, and I'm going to figure out what this symbol means. And while you can find out what symbols meant at different times and in different places, you will never exhaust that symbol's meaning. And that's one of the sort of underlying things in Jung's idea about an archetype.
Yes.
It's something invisible and very powerful and something that you cannot really pin down. And that's why a lot of people have trouble with Jungian psychology, because it can be very ambiguous. But that's the nature of the mysteries. They are,
well, it's ambiguous because it is universal, you know, that it withstands, yes, time or this culture or this region. You're right. I mean, it's very much an archetypal, symbols are archetypal, that they can't, yeah, you said they can't be pinned down, but they're eternal and they're internal. And it's up to us to unpack the symbolism and really what it means. And, you know, I'm talking about this water thing again. And what Isis also represents is the scales, but it's balancing between the water and the heat or the sun or the light, the darkness and the light. And we even see this in this image from the Secret Teachings. Isis is, yeah, flanked on each side by two huge pillars.
I'm going to hold that up.
Okay.
I'm going to hold that up real quick.
Sure.
So there is that image right there, or you can, you know, maybe cut it in later, but go ahead. So she's flanked by those pillars.
Yeah. And that could be relating to the two pillars of masonry. There's a dark and a light one, Boaz and Joaquin. Is that?
Joaquin.
Joaquin, okay.
Joaquin, yeah.
So, and then she stands in the middle. So with the scales, with the pillars, with the sun and the moon, she's more than just, you know, the earth, like a static thing. It's really this, what comes out of this harmony between these dynamic opposites. So you could also think of yin and yang, that in that, using that model, she would be the harmony between the two, the Tao, perhaps, not just the, you know, dark yin, you know, feminine, mm-hmm, aspect. She really encapsulates both of them, weighs them and balances them. And then you have harmony and the symbolism.
Yeah, I think that's why it's a great point. And placing her between those two pillars shows that equilibrating effect that she has. She is neither one nor the other, though she has a feminine symbolism mainly. She's really beyond the masculine or beyond the feminine, and those two forces interact. She becomes something quite different as the equilibrating force between the two of them. And when you look at that, I mean, you see the interplay of those positive and negative energies. That's what allows materiality to exist. And of course, then, you know, she is that force. She's the force behind this material world. And looking at it that way, then it becomes something really quite mysterious. And I love that pillar symbolism. Very interesting. Very interesting. Thanks for bringing that up. It also reminds one of the pillars on the tree of life, the Kabbalistic tree of life. She would be the middle pillar. There's a pillar on the right and a pillar on the left. I mean, and then there's a middle pillar, and one is, you know, there's a severity, and then there's a pillar of mercy. And then the middle is the sort of equilibrium, the pillar of mildness, and it's the sort of equilibrating force. Equilibrating? Am I saying that correctly?
I guess.
Equilibrating?
That sounds good enough. Sounds like,
sure,
a word.
Sure,
we can use,
sure,
it.
Why not? See, this is what happens when you go to public school, you know, and though I do have a graduate degree, the public school is still deep in there. So, at any rate, she is the force between those two forces that allows materiality to exist. And I find that quite interesting. Okay, so let us go to this that I wanted to talk about. And this is kind of a freeform one because we actually didn't even talk about this before the show. So the great mother archetype, the sort of mother nature, the fount of life, symbolism, motherhood, nurturing, life, generativity, and so on are all sort of wrapped up in this Isis symbolism, this Virgin Mary symbolism, you know, sort of pagan nature goddesses, Ceres and so forth, are all wrapped up in the same kind of symbolism. But here's another interesting, so the flip side of this would be Isis's sister Nephthys, or let's look at some, like what would be known as the devouring mother, the dark mother, symbolized in mythology made by Kali. There's other dark mother figures, devouring mothers, destroyers. And this is an archetype that's interesting because it really, like I said, it's the flip side of this. It's destructive. But it's the, you know, it's the counterbalance to life. I mean, death goes hand in hand with life, obviously. Interestingly enough though, in psychology, this devouring mother, symbolism is associated with things like the Oedipal complex, mother complexes, and so on, if you know anything about those, whereby the male or female son or daughter of a mother that's overbearing cannot pull away from that mothering sort of influence. And that's where the sort of the dark side of it comes out when consciousness isn't allowed to develop out of that. The individuation process cannot unfold with that kind of smothering, mothering energy. Mostly it manifests in men, but the dark mother can also manifest in females in different ways as well. But let's talk a little bit about that devouring mother archetype, yes?
Yes, well, even the creatures of nature, it's a kind of a brutal planet that we live on. I mean, we kind of have to kill each other in order to survive, or at least we have to kill plants and animals. As far as humans, animals are always either killing each other or trying to evade capture and consumption. It is just the cycle of life. It just happens to be how this earth plane and the world we live in is created, or how it evolved. But it's an undeniable, and you can't really separate it out. You can't just put on, you know, half a blinder and look at it's the creator and nurturer and giving birth to all living things, and it's wonderful. It really, there is that other side, the two sides to it. It's the destruction is really transformation, and I think that's what this is really getting at, this dynamic. So you have the system making this noise, and it's constantly moving. It moves forward. New life springs forth. It grows and matures, and regenerates, that it's, you know, this generative aspect. And then there's this dying and then recycling or rebirth or reincarnation, or even if it's just the next generation, mm-hmm. or a tree that goes dormant in the fall and in the winter, then springs forth again. Now there's new buds, new life, new leaves and fruit that come forth. So it's really transformation of all things. And also, like we were talking about, you know, moisture and heat, mm-hmm. You know, sun and moon, heaven and earth, visible, invisible, this yeah. balancing, harmonizing factor. It's also the life and death that, you know, in a way she holds both.
So in that darker aspect, kind of getting back to that psychological part of it, I think those, maybe it's some of those death aspects from the death and resurrection and the death and rebirth sort of symbolism. But then you have this sort of the devouring mother as well, which is something that we see, as I said, psychologically speaking, it might be connected to something like witch figures. Like, for example, in Hansel and Gretel, the witch that's inside of the gingerbread house, or some of these kinds of figures, the wicked queens in the fairy tales, wicked mm-hmm. stepmothers in fairy tales and things like that. And those are some of the darker, more sort of non-constructive dark sides of the mother, we'd say. And psychologically, then they kind of play themselves out in our lives, holding us back, because that nurturing is fantastic. It's a beautiful thing. But at some point, the mother aspect, the nurturing aspect, has to kick the baby bird out of the nest, or it'll never learn to fly. And so that's where that dark mother, that devouring mother comes in. And in our own lives, you know, we can see it with some of these, this overprotective parenting and so on that goes on today, where kids are not allowed to go out and make the mistakes that they need to make, rough house, play, learn the limits of things and so on. But they become smothered by this devouring mother energy that, while its intentions are good, it plays out in a super negative way that actually inhibits growth. It inhibits the growth, thus the devouring of the children. And that's another dark and kind of interesting aspect of it, but something to look out. That's the flip side of the positive sort of motif of death and rebirth, or the converse of that, the life-giving and generative qualities of the great mother. This would be the psychological devouring mother, and that's one of the dark aspects psychologically as far as human beings go. You want to,
like a mother complex, where you become so attached to the mother, whether it's, you know, the physical, you know, human mother, or if it's the collective or anything that has that that mother, or you know, if you're so connected with your school, or anything that kind of gives you a platform to the point, to a fault, to where you're not growing as an individual. You know, it can be very safe, I guess, if you stay either at home, or whether it's your job, or even in academia, people can really disappear.
Sure.
And never really become who they are, because they're sort of lost in this you know, complex of what, you know, maybe does provide nurture and sustainability. But if that is so dependent, if we're so dependent upon that, then you're just always looking for, you know, feed me, you know, feed the baby bird.
And getting back to the pillars that you were talking about, Isis sitting between those two pillars. If you look at one of the pillars being sort of like nurturing on one side, and then it's sort of severe, I want to say severity, but more of like correction on the other side, they sort of setting boundaries and limits and so on the other, and kind of sits between the two, equilibrium between those two. But you're right. I mean, I like that baby bird analogy. It's like, yeah, you're sitting there with your mouth open, feed me, feed me, feed me, and there's no mother bird to do that, then you're going to starve. So you've got to learn how to get out of that nest and fend for yourself, right?
Right, right. And, you know, just, again, we're talking about symbolism, even if we talk about something that's very gender oriented, you know, these are aspects, these are traits and archetypes, and they can exist whether it's a, you know, a boy or a girl or anything like that. And it really transcends that. So we're not really getting into a binary gender thing.
But I mean, biologically speaking, though, and this is where we get into a lot of these gender issues, is that there is biology, and there's hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary development into male and female. And we can ask questions of that, and we can ask questions of what does it mean to be a patriarchal society or a matriarchal society. But some of these things are rooted in biological and evolutionary structures within the genetic coding in us as well. I mean, we can't forget that. You know what I mean? In the larger discussion, I'm not trying to to dismantle those gender questions. But it is important to also look at some of how these archetypal images connect to those biological and kind of the historical trajectory of society as well, right? So,
sure. Well, it's how the things got named in the first place, because, you know, how we, at least as ancients and primitives, you know, that's how we learned, was through looking at each other, ourselves, the world around us, nature, what nature was doing. And we were very clear. I mean, we're talking about birds. I mean, the difference between a female and a male bird is pretty dramatic. You can really see this. So yes, definitely differences. And yes, they are grounded in biological genders. But as we're working with symbols, they can also go beyond that. And exactly. So we don't have to be limited by that.
Great point. And that's, I just wanted to add that little bit in there that, you know, like we said, you cannot put clear boundaries around symbolism. And though the ancients, you know, used some of these physical representations to model certain ideas, they go well beyond that as well. All right. With that, actually, I think we should probably wrap it up, because I noticed we're about 10 or 11 minutes into this, and we've got probably 40 minutes on the other one. I do want to thank everybody for joining us today. We are going to get more into this symbolism. We covered today Isis, and we looked at Manly Hall's chapter. It is chapter 8 of The Secret Teachings, Isis, the Virgin of the World. Fantastic read. Please read it when you get a chance. Do support us if you can, anchor.fm/cosmiceye, and you can we could really use your financial support. But also follow us if you're on iTunes or whatever service you're using to listen to us on the podcast. Follow us there and like us. And if you get a chance, do check out the video. We'll have a link up to that if we can work out our technical difficulties that we experienced today. But we did get a podcast out of it, at least. And we know that Isis was looking over us, being generative with that. So we do have the podcast to fall back on. But hopefully we'll be able to put up a video as well, and we'll put a link to that if we're able to do that. Thank you, Chris, for your insightful information today. And thank you for everybody for joining us. We're here every Sunday, and we appreciate you listening. Goodbye. Have a great week, and God bless.